The Synthesis of Yoga, Sri Aurobindo. Continuing in Part 3, The Yoga of Divine Love, and Chapter 3, The Godward Emotions, the second half of this chapter, mid-page 565. Certainly fear enters into the relations of the master and the servant, and even of the father and the child. But only when they are on the human level, when control and subjection and punishment figure predominantly in them, and love is obliged to efface itself more or less behind the mask of authority. The divine, even as the master, does not punish anybody, does not threaten, does not force obedience. It is the human soul that has freely to come to the divine and offer itself to his overpowering force that he may seize and uplift it towards his own divine levels and give it that joy of mastery of the finite nature by the infinite and of service to the highest by which there comes freedom from the ego and the lower nature. Love is the key of this relation. And this service, Dasyam, is in Indian yoga the happy service of the divine friend or the passionate service to the divine beloved. The master of the worlds, who in the Gita demands of his servant, the Bhakta, to be nothing more in life than his instrument, makes this claim as the friend, the guide, the higher self, and describes himself as the Lord of all the worlds, who is the friend of all creatures. Sarvalokama Esvaram Surdam Sarvabhutanam. The two relations, in fact, must go together, and neither can be perfect without the other. So, too, it is not the fatherhood of God as the Creator who demands obedience because He is the maker of our being, but the fatherhood of love, which leads us towards the closer soul union of yoga. Love is the real key in both, and perfect love is inconsistent with the admission of the motive of fear. Closeness of the human soul to the divine is the object, and fear sets always a barrier and a distance. Even awe and reverence for the divine power are a sign of distance and division, and they disappear in the intimacy of the union of love. Moreover, fear belongs to the lower nature, to the lower self, and in approaching the higher self must be put aside before we can enter into its presence. This relation of the divine fatherhood and the closer relation with the divine as the mother soul of the universe have their springs in another early religious motive. One type of the bhakta, says the Gita, is the devotee who comes to the divine as the giver of his wants, the giver of his good, the satisfier of the needs of his inner and his outer being. I bring to my bhakta, says the Lord, his getting and his having of good, yogakshemam vahamyaham. The life of man is a life of wants and needs, and therefore of desires, not only in his physical and vital, but in his mental and spiritual being. When he becomes conscious of a greater power governing the world, he approaches it through prayer for the fulfillment of his needs, for help in his rough journey, for protection and aid in his struggle. Whatever crudities there may be in the ordinary religious approach to God by prayer, and there are many, especially that attitude which imagines the divine as if capable of being propitiated, bribed, flattered into acquiescence or indulgence by praise, entreaty, and gifts, and has often little regard to the spirit in which he is approached. Still, this way of turning to the divine is an essential movement of our religious being and reposes on universal truth. The efficacy of prayer is often doubted, and prayer itself supposed to be a thing irrational and necessarily superfluous and ineffective. It is true that the universal will executes always its aim and cannot be deflected by egoistic propitiation and entreaty. It is true of the transcendent, who expresses himself in the universal order, that being omniscient, his larger knowledge must foresee the thing to be done, and it does not need direction or stimulation by human thought, and that the individual's desires are not and cannot be in any world order the true determining factor. But neither is that order, or the execution of the universal will, altogether affected by mechanical law, but by powers and forces of which, for human life at least, human will, aspiration, and faith, are not among the least important. Prayer is only a particular form given to that will, aspiration, and faith. Its forms are very often crude, and not only childlike, which is in itself no defect, but childish. But still, it has a real power and significance. Its power and sense is to put the will, aspiration, and faith of man into touch with the divine will, as that of a conscious being with whom we can enter into conscious and living relations. For our will and aspiration can act either by our own strength and endeavor, which can no doubt be made a thing great and effective, whether for lower or higher purposes, and there are plenty of disciples which put it forward as the one force to be used, or it can act in dependence upon and with subordination to the divine or the universal will. And this latter way again may either look upon that will as responsive indeed to our aspiration, but almost mechanically, by a sort of law of energy, or at any rate quite impersonally. Or else it may look upon it as responding consciously to the divine aspiration and faith of the human soul, and consciously bringing to it the help, the guidance, the protection and fruition demanded. Yogak simam vahayaham. Prayer helps to prepare this relation for us at first on the lower plane, even while it is there consistent with much that is mere egoism and self-delusion. But afterwards, we can draw towards the spiritual truth which is behind it. It is not then the giving of the thing asked for that matters, but the relation itself, the contact of man's life with God, the conscious interchange. In spiritual matters, and in the seeking of spiritual gains, this conscious relation is a great power. It is a much greater power than our own entirely self-reliant struggle and effort, and it brings a fuller spiritual growth and experience. Necessarily, in the end, prayer either ceases in the greater thing for which it prepared us. In fact, the form we call prayer is not itself essential so long as the faith, the will, the aspiration are there, or remains only for the joy of the relation. Also, its objects, the artha, or interest it seeks to realize, become higher and higher until we reach the highest motiveless devotion, which is that of divine love, pure and simple, without any other demand or longing. The relations which arise out of this attitude towards the divine are that of the divine father and the mother with the child, and that of the divine friend. To the divine, as these things, the human soul comes for help, for protection, for guidance, for fruition, or if knowledge be the aim, to the guide, teacher, giver of light, for the divine is the sun of knowledge. Or it comes in pain and suffering for relief and solace and deliverance. It may be deliverance either from the suffering itself or from the world existence, which is the habitat of the suffering, or from all its inner and real causes. These are the three of the four classes of devotee which are recognized by the Gita: Artha, Arthartha, Jinyasu, the distressed, the seeker of personal objects, and the seeker of God knowledge. In these things we find there is a certain gradation. For the relation of fatherhood is always less close, intense, passionate, intimate, and therefore it is less resorted to in the yoga, which seeks for the closest union. That of the divine friend is a thing sweeter and more intimate, admits of an equality and intimacy even in equality, and the beginning of mutual self-giving. At its closest, when all idea of other giving and taking disappears, when this relation becomes motiveless, except for the one sole, all-sufficing motive of love, it turns into the free and happy relation of the playmate in the lila of existence. But closer and more intimate still is the relation of the mother and the child. And that, therefore, plays a very large part wherever the religious impulse is most richly fervent and springs most warmly from the heart of man. The soul goes to the mother soul in all its desires and troubles, and the divine mother wishes that it should be so, so that she may pour out her heart of love. It turns to her too, because of the self-existent nature of this love, and because that points us to the home towards which we turn from our wanderings in the world, and to the bosom in which we find our rest. But the highest and the greatest relation is that which starts from none of the ordinary religious motives, but is rather of the very essence of yoga, springs from the very nature of love itself. It is the passion of the lover and the beloved. Wherever there is the desire of the soul for its utter union with God, this form of the divine yearning makes its way even into religions which seem to do without it and give it no place in their ordinary system. Here, the one thing asked for is love. The one thing feared is the loss of love. The one sorrow is the sorrow of separation of love, for all other things either do not exist for the lover or come in only as incidents or as results, and not as objects or conditions of love. All love is indeed in its nature self-existent because it springs from a secret oneness in being and a sense of that oneness or desire of oneness in the heart between souls that are yet able to conceive of themselves as different from each other and divided. Therefore, all these other relations too can arrive at their self-existent, motiveless joy of being for the sake of love alone. But still, they start from, and to the end, they, to some extent, find a satisfaction of their play in other motives. But here the beginning is love, and the end is love, and the whole aim is love. There is indeed the desire of possession, but even this is overcome in the fullness of the self-existent love, and the final demand of the bhakta is simply that his bhakti may never cease nor diminish. He does not ask for heaven or for liberation from birth or for any other object, but only that his love may be eternal and absolute. Love is a passion, and it seeks for two things, eternity and intensity. And in the relation of the lover and beloved, the seeking for eternity and for intensity is instinctive and self-born. Love is a seeking for mutual possession, and it is here that the demand for mutual possession becomes absolute. Passing beyond desire of possession, which means a difference, it is a seeking for oneness. And it is here that the idea of oneness, of two souls merging into each other and becoming one, finds the acme of its longing and the utterness of its satisfaction. Love, too, is a yearning for beauty. And it is here that the yearning is eternally satisfied in the vision and the touch and the joy of the all-beautiful. Love is a child and a seeker of delight, and it is here that it finds the highest possible ecstasy, both of the heart consciousness and of every fiber of the being. Moreover, this relation is that which, as between human being and human being, demands the most and, even while reaching the greatest intensities, is still the least satisfied. Because only in the divine can it find its real and its utter satisfaction. Therefore it is here most that the turning of human emotion Godwards finds its full meaning and discovers all the truth of which love is the human symbol, all its essential instincts divinized, raised, satisfied in the bliss from which our life was born, and towards which, by oneness, it returns in the ananda of the divine existence, where love is absolute, eternal, and unalloyed. End of Chapter 3, The Godward Emotions, page 570.